We began this course by seeing that, in fact, contrary to a popular misconception, there is basically no argument for saying that there is a gender gap in obligation when it comes to prayer. Until the 17th century, no one even suggests that women are in some way less obligated in prayer than men. That simply does not exist in any source. Beginning of the 17th century, you start to see this tendency, really in one figure in particular, the Magen Avraham, who wants to say that, well, women around me aren't davening. I don't want to assume that they are transgressors. So let me find a way, even if it is far-fetched, to argue that they are not fully obligated. That always remains a minority view. Folks like the Mishneh Berurah reject it as the minority view, but it is there as a way to offer a defense of the practice of real people in real time. And we also saw that there are other ways to do that without making some sort of ontological claim that women and men are fundamentally different when it comes to prayer. So that was the first week. And then the second and third weeks, we sort of followed that up by saying, and the same is true for obligation to pray with the minyan, where either there's no obligation for anyone, or if there is an obligation, there's no reason to think that it would be gendered. Based on that, we spent the next 2 weeks after that looking at questions of reading Torah and leading davening, seeing that they're also, like with prayer in the community, for the most part, the discourse is one of communal obligation rather than individual obligation, in which case there's no concern of being needing to be obligated. None of us are obligated. And even if you follow the sort of the other voice, which is a real voice, even if it is a minority one, that talks about these ideas, things like Kedusha as an obligation, there's no reason to think that that would be gendered as well. We don't see any explicit statements from classical commentators that that is gendered. So we got to a point of saying, okay, so in terms of leading the prayer service, there is a strong argument, I believe a very strong argument, for fully egalitarian leading of prayers. Today and next week, we turn to what I think is the most interesting of these three topics, which is the question of counting in a minyan. I think it's interesting both because the halakhic path we will take to understand what would it mean to say women do or do not count in a minyan, I think that is interesting. I also think that it is fascinating to think, irrespective of the questions of gender, what this says about what it is we're doing when we are constituting a minyan. What is it that my presence in a room with nine other, I will say Jews, I will say adult halakhic Jews, some of you, if you want to say, well, at least for the time being, halakhic male Jews, that's what we're going to be talking about. But irrespective of gender, just the question of what does it mean to constitute a minyan, we will see as a fascinating question. So I'm going to start with two sources that we've already seen. We saw this when we were talking about the question of leading Dvarim Shebik Dusha, those things that require a minyan. We focus on what they meant about the leadership of those passages. But now we're going to focus on the question of, well, what does this mean about the minyan itself? What, if anything, do these sources tell us about the meaning of minyan itself? Okay. Mishneh Megillah, source number one. Ein porsin al shma. We talked about this last time. This is sort of some kind of practice of a responsive recitation of shma that we no longer do. Whatever it is, we no longer do it. Ein obrin lifnei ateva. One does not go to be a communal prayer leader. Ein nosinus kapehem. The priests don't do the priestly blessing. The ein korim b'torah. We don't read Torah. The ein mafterim b'navi. We don't do the haftorah. The ein osin mamaru moshav. This is a standing, sitting ritual that was done for the mourners. The ein omrim birkas aveilim and tanchumei aveilim. We don't recite the blessing for the mourners and the formal liturgicized comforting of the mourners. Ubirkas chasanim. We don't say sheva brachas. The ein mezamnin b'shem. We don't say God's name Elokeinu in the zimun. All of these are different ritual acts that we don't do with pachos me'asara, with less than 10. That is to say, there's a whole host of acts, most if not all of which we call Dvarim Shebik Dusha, acts that are done in holiness with fewer than 10. The last line here, for the sake of time, I'm not going to go into. It's just a little wrinkle that we just said, but doesn't change anything for our purposes. So we have these things that require 10, but 10 what, right? We don't really have any guidance here as to 10. Do we need 10 Jews? Do we need 10 adult Jews? Do we need 10 men? Do we need 10 women? We don't really know anything from this mission about who constitutes the 10. You could imagine, and I don't need to imagine because I've heard people try to do it, that the fact that the word 10 here in the Hebrew, asara, is in the masculine form. Asara is a masculine form of the word 10. The feminine form would have been eser. You could imagine someone saying, oh, well, it says asara, that implies 10 men. But that would be a terrible argument. That would be contradicted by all sorts of other sources, because as those of you who know, Hebrew being not only a gendered language, but a language that generally assumes male normativity, when you have a mixed group, you use the, at least until recently, use the masculine form. So asara, that male form of 10, could mean 10 men, but it could just as easily mean 10 people of a mixed group, right? So we don't really know anything from this mission about who counts toward the 10. And now we see the Gemara on that mission, which we've already seen this particular Gemara, but I want to turn our focus now from the question of leading these prayers to the question of counting towards the minyan for this. Source number 2, Minahane Mile. How do we know this? Where do we get this idea that there are things that require 10? Again, irrespective of who can be towards that 10, how do we know there are things that require 10 of some kind of people? Amar Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, the Amar Kra, because we have a verse that says, this is the verse from Leviticus 22, V'nikdashti b'sof b'nei Israel, I will be sanctified amidst the people Israel. And notice that word bitoch, right? Amidst, in the middle of, that's going to be an important word here. Kol davar shebikdusha lo yehi pachos me'asara. Anything that is a davar shebikdusha, which frustratingly they don't define here, they assume you know what that means. And we're going to just sort of have a tautological definition of it, which is the things that require 10, right? Any of these things that are called davar shebikdusha, they require 10. That's the definition of them. It doesn't really help us figure out what they are, but that's a statement. Now you might wonder, how does this verse, I will be sanctified amidst the people of Israel, how does that prove that I need 10? Well, the Gemara wonders that also. My mashma, what about that verse, V'nikdashti b'sof b'nei Israel? What about, I will be sanctified amidst the people of Israel? What about that implies that I need 10, right? Clearly I need Jews, I need b'nei Israel, but why do I need 10? Maybe I need 100, maybe I need 5, right? How do I know that I need 10? Says the Gemara, Detane Rabbi Chiya, as Rabbi Chiya taught, Asiya toch, it comes from a shared word of toch, right? This is called a gzeira shava. When you have two verses in the Torah that share a word, usually an unusual word, although here it's not, we assume that what's true of one must be true of the other. So our verse said, I will be sanctified bit toch b'nei Israel, hachavidik dashti b'soch b'nei Israel, right? Uksiv hatam, and there in the book of Numbers it's written, kibadlu mitoch haida. Again, that separate yourselves from the midst of this congregation. And there also we get the same word toch. So I've now connected Leviticus 22 to Numbers 14, right? So these two verses have something in common because they both share the word toch. Ve'asya eda eda. And now we're going to connect that second verse from Numbers 14 to a third verse, also from Numbers 14, Dichsiv Hatam. In that other verse it says, Ad masail eda hara'a zos. How long will I have to struggle with this evil congregation? And in both the second verse, kibadlu mitocha eda, separate yourselves from the congregation, the eda, and the third verse, how long will I have to struggle with this evil congregation? Eda, I've got eda. So verse 1, I'll be sanctified amidst toch, connects to verse 2, separate out from toch, from amidst the congregation. Verse 2 connects to verse 3, separate from the congregation and how long with this evil congregation. And therefore, what's true of verse 3 must also be true of verse 1. Now, those second and third verses are from the book of Numbers, the story of the spies. How many spies were there? There were 12 spies. How many of them were evil? Well, Yeshua and Kalev, they were not evil. They brought back, this is the story of the spies bringing back an evil report about the land of Israel. And for that reason, we were kept out of the land for 40 years. But two of the spies said, no, the land is good. We can actually conquer it. That was Yoshua and Caleb. So they're good guys. So 12 minus 2 is 10. So how many evil spies were there? There were 10 evil spies. Since there were 10 evil spies in verse 3, what does it mean to be sanctified amidst the people? There were 10 evil spies in verse 3. So what does it mean to be sanctified amidst the people of Israel in verse 1? Amidst 10, I'll say Jews, even though that's not totally obvious right now. Malahala Nasara, just as there in verse number 3, it's 10. Afkan Asara. So to hear by the Devarim Shepik Dusha verse, I was sanctified amidst the people of Israel, it's 10. Now, I will say at this point that you could imagine, and we'll see in a moment in two sources, that you could imagine actually trying to take more from that than just 10, right? You could imagine trying to say, well, I know that it's 10. I also know that it's 10 Jews, right? Because the Jews were all spies. And therefore, in our case, we're talking about Minyan, I also need 10 Jews. You could also imagine, and again, I don't need to imagine because I and probably many of you have heard people say this, oh, well, since the spies were all men, therefore that also proves that we need men for minyan. The first thing to note is that while that is possible, the Gemara does not do that. The only thing the Gemara derives here from the spies is the number. It does not derive the nature, the identity of who counts a dominion from the spies. One could do that, but one is then adding on to what the Gemara has done. I will also say that doing that, especially if you don't have a base in the Gemara to do that, is a bit of a risky proposition, because all the spies were likewise over the age of 20. So you could therefore say, oh, to count a dominion, you have to be over the age of 20. Or you could imagine saying, in fact, we'll see, probably not today, probably next week, a source that actually suggests this, not in a serious way, that's a sort of rejected idea. You could imagine saying, well, all the spies were evil. So maybe only evil people count a dominion, right? So once you recognize that there are all sorts of identities that the spies have, and the Gemara does not do anything with those identities, you're on very shaky ground if what you want to do, as some people will try to do, is to say, oh, well, since the spies were all men, therefore the dominion also has to be all men. So I want to emphasize that suggestion, which I'm sure many of you have heard before, is not in the Gemara. One could do it. We always have to add things to the Gemara, right? The Gemara does not give us, you know, answers to every question we might have, but that particular attempt would be a very shaky and unreasonable one. Okay. We're going to see a very similar Gemara in two sources, but before we do that, one more source is going to become very, very relevant to our learning. And this is, again, a source that we saw many weeks ago when we talked about the obligation to pray with the community. Source number three, Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi says, Af al pi she'amru katan hamutal barisa ein mezamnin alav. Even though they've already said that a minor, a child, even lying in the cradle, that is to say, even a baby, right? One does not include them in a zimun. Well, that makes sense. I don't know about your kids, but my kids, when they were babies, would not have been reasonable to answer to the zimun, the introduction to the grace after meals that we said when you have three or more who eat together. Aval, osin oso snifla sara. But you may count them as an appendix, as an addition, as an adjunct to the 10. And to the 10 here is a little bit ambiguous, right? Since we're talking about zimun, you might think that it could be for the 10 for Zimun. We have three, I'll say Jews, but some people say men. We have three Jews who eat together, we say the Zimun. We have 10 Jews who eat together, we add the word Elokeinu, one of God's names, to the Zimun. So maybe it means that the minor, even though they don't count towards the three for Zimun, they can count as an adjunct, meaning presumably as one of the 10 for adding Elokeinu. You can also imagine this is more expansive, that once we're talking about 10 for Zimun, well, maybe all minyanim are the same, right? The minyan for Zimun and the minyan for prayer have the same standards, the same requirements. And so maybe what we're saying is a child could even count as an adjunct, as one of the 10 in a minyan. So this is an idea that that Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi puts forward. V'amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, and Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi also says, Tishva Eved Mitzarfin, by the way, 9 adult halakhic Jews and an Eved, also a slave, also combined to make a minyan of 10. An Eved, we've spoken about this before, according to classical Jewish sources, they are not Jewish, but they are obligated in mitzvahs at the same level of, classically speaking, a woman. And that, classically speaking, is important. You'll get to that next week with Rav Eitan about whether that's the only way to understand this. But classically, women and slaves in rabbinic literature are not obligated in positive time-bound commandments. So an Eved, presumably because they are, well, we'll get more to this later, but for whatever reason, 9 adult halakhic Jews and an Eved can combine to make a minyan as well, according to Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. But now the Gemara is going to object to this. Meisvei. We object from the following earlier source. Matzah b'Rabbi Eliezer shenichnas l'beis haknesses b'lo matzah asara. It once happened that Rabbi Eliezer went to Shul. He didn't find 10 Jews there. So what did he do? Shichrer avdo v'shlimo l'asara. He freed his slave and counted the slave towards the 10, used that freed slave to count as the 10. Now, wait a minute. If what Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi in the second paragraph here said was true, right? He said 9 and a slave make a minion. Well, if that's the case, then why would Rabbi Eliezer free his slave in order to make the minion, right? Shouldn't he could have just left the slave enslaved? I mean, this is all terrible to say, right? Of course, we'd want all slaves to be liberated. But in the terms of the Gemara, right, he could have just left his slave enslaved, and that would have made the minyan, right? Shichrer in, lo shichrer lo, right? It sounds like if he freed him, then he counts towards the minyan, and if he doesn't free him, then he wouldn't count towards the minyan. That seems to be an objection to Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. The Gemara resolves this and defends Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi's position. Trey itzderichu shichr achad v'nafik b'chad. Ah, the actual case was that Rabbi Eliezer got to Shul, and he didn't see nine adult halakhic Jews there. He saw eight halakhic adult Jews there. So what does he do? He has two slaves with him. He frees one. So now you have nine adult halakhic Jews, because the process of emancipation, according to the rabbis, is also a process of conversion. Once you are emancipated as a non-Jewish slave, you become a full Jew. And the second one, they counted as the slave. So you have nine and one. Now, this may seem far-fetched, but this is a classic sort of move for the Gemara to make to sort of limit the case so that the positions hold together. And that's where we leave this Gemara. So we leave this Gemara with a specific Rabbi Shimon Levi that was challenged but then defended, that nine adult halakhic Jews and the slave can count towards the minyan. And that goes along with his position that a minor can also be counted as one of the 10 in a minyan. We're going to leave this source aside for now, but it's going to become important later in our learning today. Okay, let's move on then. One more passage from the Gemara before we get to the real meat of our topic today. So, source number 4. Now we're switching gears entirely. Notice we're now in Tractate Sanhedrin, source number 4. We're no longer talking about prayer, but rather Kiddush Hashem, the sanctification of God's name, which in a halachic sense has a more specific meaning than just doing something nice that makes God look good in the world, but specifically the mitzvah of martyrdom. When do you have to die rather than violate a mitzvah? This is a whole complicated topic. We're not going to get into the details. But one thing that the Gemara says in Tractate Sanhedrin is that if you are in public, the Greek word, which is the Aramaic word as well, if you're in a parhesia, then you have to die rather than violate a commandment. Do not take any practical halakhic guidance out of what we're saying here. God willing, this will never be relevant to you, and you'll never have to think about this. But right now, we're just going with what the Gemara says, and all these things get sort of qualified and challenged in later sources. But the Gemara's position is, if you're in public in a parhesia, you must die rather than violate a commandment. So says the Gemara, the chama parhesia. Well, if I need to die rather than violate a commandment, if I'm in public, I better know what counts as public, right? If I'm with three other people, that doesn't seem like public. And if I'm with 5,000, that does. So what does it mean to be in public? Amar Rabbi Yaakov, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan says, Ein parhesia pachosa miyasara b'nei adam. Parhesia is not less than 10 people. In other words, to make a parhesia, I need 10. Not surprising, right? We also know 10 from minyan, so this is going to be the same sort of thing. But now we get a question. Shita, Yisraelim b'ayinam. Obviously, those 10 people need to be Jews. Not so obvious to me, but it's obvious to them, right? If I'm in a group of 100 Gentiles, I don't need to die rather than violate the law. Only if I'm in front of 10 or more Jews, says the Gemara, do I need to die rather than violate the law. How do I know that? Dichsiv, v'nikdashti b'soch b'nei Yisrael. As it's written, our old friend from Leviticus 22, I will sanctify the midst b'nei Yisrael, right? When do I need to sanctify God's name? When I'm in front of other Jews. And therefore, I need the 10 for the parhesia to be Jews. That is the obvious thing. Again, for us, that might not be obvious. If this were a class on Kiddush Hashem, I would love to talk more about this. But what matters for us is actually what comes next. By Rabbi Yirmiya, who's known for asking sort of off the beaten path questions, Rabbi Yirmiya comes along and says, Pisha Yisrael v'nokri echad mau. Okay, I get that I need to have Jews to make a parhesia, right? But what if I have 9 Jews and 1 Gentile? If I look at a room of 9 people with one identity and a 10th person with another identity, I might look at that as a room having the identity of the 9, right? Because I've got 10 people there. It looks like a big popular group. And the vast majority of those people have the same identity. So I got, you know, when I was in college, my suite was 5 Shomer Shabbos Jews and 1 evangelical Christian. And I think most people looked at our suite as a Jewish room, a very Jewish room, even though one of the people there was an evangelical Christian. And so Rabbi Yirmiya is saying, if I got 9 Jews in a room and 1 Gentile, does that count as a parhesia such that I would need to violate, such that I need to die rather than violate the law? So we need an answer to that question. Tashma, come and learn. The Tana Rabbi Yane Ahuad Rabbi Chia Bar Abba. We get a teaching from Rabbi Chia Bar Rabbi Yane, the brother of Rabbi Chia Bar Abba. Asya toch, siv hacha v'nikdash tibas open in Israel, uksiv hatam, kiva lumi tochai gazos. Right, the same verses we had before. It skips verse number 2, but that doesn't really matter for our purposes. Mala halan asara v'chul hu Yisrael, afkan asara v'chul Yisrael. Just as there, the spies are all Jews, right? Here too, in the case of Parhesia, I need all Jews. So this Gemara does exactly what I told you the previous Gemara does not do, right? This Gemara takes out from the spies, not only that I need 10, not only the number, but also the identity. But not on a gendered axis, but on a religious identity axis. Just like the spies are all Jews, so too all the people in a Parhesia must be Jews. 9 Jews and 1 non-Jew is not good enough to make it public, such that you need to die rather than violate the commandments. Okay. Right. So here we do have that learning of identity. And that opens up a door, I would say. Right. And in fact, there are some people who have argued, you'll actually see one of them next week in the context of Kiddush Hashem, not in the context of Davening and Dominion, who will argue that we can actually do a similar thing with gender and try to figure out whether gender is relevant here. Although you could also say, well, I'll leave that for Rav Eitan for next week, actually. Okay.
I mean, I'll say what I've said before, which is the fact that we keep running out halakhic precedents from stories that don't necessarily demonstrate a straight line between, you know, what they're saying they demonstrate and what they're running out is, you know, I get that it's a thing we're doing, but like, I don't know how I feel about it.
Yeah. No, and I think I forget what I said when you raised this last time, Rachel, but my instinct today, I hope it's the same as what I said last time. My instinct today is that what I think that reveals is that they know instinctively that 10 is a significant number, right? And I say that for two reasons. One is that, you know, when you've got 10, you do feel like you've got a crowd in the room, right? If you've got a room with 10 people, you can't really sort of like count them all at once, right? If I see 3 people, I'm like, oh, I see 3 people. You're not supposed to count Jews anyway. But if you see 3 Jews, you can be like, oh yeah, that's 3, because I don't need to count 1, 2, 3. I just see the 3 and recognize them. Whereas once I get to a number like 10, it's already enough that it's like hard to actually sort of visually just eyeball that. So that's already a crowd. Why 10 and not 9? Why 10 and not 11? Well, we're base 10 people, right? We've got 10 fingers. And so we count in base 10. As a result, multiples of 10 are going to be numbers we latch on to, right? Is it objectively like better to have 10 than 9? No, but something around that is the number at which we need to say we've got a crowd. And 10 is the number that makes sense to us as base 10 organisms. And so I think that's the way to get to 10. And then what they have to do is find a way to justify that, right? And once you're in that model, you're not really learning it from the spies, right? It's not a real derivation, but what the Gemara would call an asmachta, right? A verse that sort of justifies what we already know in our guts. So I think that's really what's going on here.
Yeah, aren't we wearing this learning from Toch B'Toch a bit much? I mean, we're learning, usually just learn one thing from a pasuk, and then you've exhausted it. And here we're giving it quite a workout.
Right. Yeah, so there's an idea that you see primarily in the Bavli, in the Babylonian Talmud, and not so much in other rabbinic texts. You can only get one halakhic insight from each idiosyncrasy in the biblical text. So whenever that happens, what either the Gemara or later commentators have to do is try to figure out, well, what's the extra inconsistency here? So presumably if I'm not so bothered by that because I know that this is sort of a literary move of the Talmud rather than a substantive one. But if someone were sort of really bothered by that, I think what they would try to find, what's the second inconsistency here? Or maybe say, well, there's Toch Toch and there's Ada, maybe that's the doubling. So I think that's, you know, I hear that as a technical challenge to the Gemara. But for whatever reason, as far as I know, no one raises that as a problem, right? No one says, oh, wait a minute, we're learning both 10 and Jews from this. Why that would be, I don't know. Okay, great. Let's move forward now. So we've seen 3 passages from the Gemara, one of which tells us I need 10, doesn't say anything about gender. One of which tells us, oh, by the way, a minor or a slave could actually count as the 10th. Interesting, we'll come back to that. And a final one, which is not about minion, but is about a very seemingly related thing. Both have to do with sanctifying God's name, right? Whether it's through prayer or through martyrdom. Also 10, and there we do get Jewishness as a requirement for being part of 10. But again, we see nothing about gender in any of these 3 sources. So let's continue on in post-Talmudic times and see, well, where do we get this idea that a minion is only 10 men and not 10 adult halakhic Jews? The earliest source we see that says this is the Siddur of Rav Sadia Gaon, 9th century, I believe, maybe 10th century, I actually forget exactly. And you see, he says source number five, the im tzibor mispalel es shlosha tfilos ha'ela. If the, this is a Siddur commentary. So when we get to this point in the prayer is when we get to Baruch Hu, that starting of Shacharis, the morning prayer. And he says, if the tzibor, if the community gets there, and then it's sort of an interruption to his own thought. He says, by the way, tzibor ha'tzibor asara zecharim shigiyu l'perkam. The measure of a tzibor, of a community, is 10 men, zecharim. And here, for the first time, we get gender mentioned explicitly with minyan. We get to, it's 10 men who have reached adulthood. Now, he doesn't tell us why that is. He doesn't give us a source. He doesn't give us reasoning. He just asserts 10 men, okay? And, you know, we get, you know, sort of thinking sociologically, we can understand, I've been told, I never looked this up, that in the Arabic Empire in which Prasad Yagon lived, the minimum number for a minority religious community was 10 men. You can imagine Prasad Yagon getting this from his surrounding culture, but whatever it is, we don't know, right? We don't know where he gets this idea of 10 men. He just asserts it. Likewise, in source number six, the Rambam, Ein korim b'tor b'tzibor b'faroz mi'asara anashim gedolim b'nei chorin. We read Torah in community only if we have 10 anashim, which could mean men or could mean people, but here it almost certainly means men, because otherwise he wouldn't need it. If he meant people, he would have just said asara gedolim, 10 adults. The fact that he adds the word anashim means he probably means the word anashim here specifically to mean men. So we need 10 adult men who are free, b'nei chorin. Again, like Rav Saad Yagon, he doesn't tell us why, no source, no reasoning. Though for the Rambam, that's typical, right? He's giving a code of law, he never gives his reasoning. And then likewise in source number seven, Aval nashim mizamnos la'atzman, o la'avadim la'atzman, ubilvajal yizamnu b'shem. Women can make a zimun on their own, slaves can make a zimun on their own. This is a whole other question we're not going to get into of zimun. Ubilvajal yizamnu b'shem. But when 10 women make a zimun together, even though 3 women may, maybe even should make a zimun together, when 10 women do that, they don't add Elokeinu. And again, he doesn't say why. He just asserts this. And so we see from Rav Saad Yagon, from the Rambam, we get this idea that 10 men make a minyan, and we don't know why. Let's turn now just to one source, just to on the specific halakhic question of zimun b'shem. So the Sefer Mel wrote, a 13th century Provençal authority, he says, Umikol makom, nireshe lo limchos biyadam milzamin b'shem, kivan shelo huzkar din zeh begemara. Sefer Me'or wrote, commenting on the Rambam, says, by the way, the Rambam says 10 women shouldn't say Elokeinu when they make a zimun, but that law does not actually appear in the Gemara. The Gemara never says 10 women don't say Elokeinu. I don't know where the Rambam got it from, says the Sefer Me'or wrote. And even though I'm not willing to go out on a limb and be like, so therefore do it, if you see people doing it, don't freak out about it. That's actually a useful voice, even though it's not an egalitarian voice, right? It's a useful voice remembering a lot of the stuff, like the volume on the conversation is so loud. And from the side of those who are arguing for egalitarianism, I understand why it is loud, because it gets to the core of who's a member of our community, as we'll see more deeply in a little bit. But in terms of sort of technical halachic argument, it's really not that big a deal, right? Like, obviously, everything's a big deal, right? We want to serve God in the most precise way possible. We always want to do our best to do it the correct way. But in terms of like how confident we are that something is right or wrong, all of these sources are post-Talmudic. And you see something like the Sefer Me'or wrote saying, therefore, I'm not going to freak out if I see people doing something that I, the Sefer Me'or wrote, think is wrong. Let them do it. Okay. But now I want to return to our topic, which is, where does this idea that 10 men make a minyan and women don't constitute the minyan, where does that come from, right? We've seen Rav Saad Yagon and the Rambam saying it, but we haven't seen an argument for why that would be the case. Source number 9 is not the first source to give these arguments, but it's a kind of compendium of all the reasons that you see in the medieval authorities. And so rather than give you all these different sources, I'm just going to give you the Rabbeinu Manoach, another commentary on the Rambam. And this will sort of give you basically everything that you see in the medieval period as to why someone might think that women don't count in a minyan. So what does Rabbeinu Manoach say? Source number 9. He begins by saying, Vetzerichiyun, where the Rambam said that women don't say Elokeinu when 10 women are benching together, that requires investigation. This thing's not in the Gemara, just like the Sefer Me'or wrote said. But nonetheless, the law is thus, that women do not say Elokeinu. Why? Dehak Siv, because it's written in Psalms, B'makelos Baruch Hu, bless God in makhelos. In modern Hebrew, makhelos is a choir, right? A congregation, a kahal. Vahane lo ikru kahal klal. And these, i.e. women, are never called a kahal, right? I'll come back to this. It's easy right now to dismiss this as just sexism. And that's certainly, there's a huge element of that to be sure. But we'll come back to try to understand in a more generous way what's going on here. But he asserts, women don't constitute a kahal. When you see them, you don't, you not you, people of the medieval period don't call them a kahal, a congregation. V'hachi nami amrinan, b'tfila d'chayvedba, v'vilo achi lo mistar v'ilasara. And also by davening, right? Where even though women are obligated davening, they don't count towards the 10. V'hen le'athman nami lo amrinan lo kadosh v'lo kedusha. And a group of 10 women, says the Rabbeinu Menoch, wouldn't say kadosh and kedusha. Why is that? The whole of Arash B'kedusha, eino b'fachos mi'asara. Right, because anything that the Darash B'Kedusha requires 10, quoting the Gemara that we've already seen, and now adding on to that, Dichsiv b'nikdashti b'sof b'nei Yisrael, below b'nos Yisrael, it says I was sanctified among the b'nei Yisrael, which I could easily and should usually translate as the children of Israel or the people Israel, but literally could also be read as the sons of Israel. And he adds below b'nos Yisrael and not the daughters of Israel, so women don't count. This is, I suspect, an argument that many of you have heard before as well. Not in the Gemara. Comes from Rabbeinu Manoach and actually some other Rishonim as well. V'eda nami b'scharim hivim v'lo b'nekevos. And congregation, Eda, also. That word Eda also means men and not women. Tahama ragam anjehavu. Because the spies from whom we learned the notion of an Eda, they were all men. That argument that we've already talked about. The chevan, the nevarish b'kdusha, lezim b'vachos me'asara anashim. And since saying God's name in the benching, in the Zimun, is a Davar Shavikdusha, and that requires B'nai Yisrael, well, therefore we're excluded from that. And finally, Rabbeinu Manoach concludes with, V'af hasvar no senes, shalo yizamnu b'shem. And it also makes logical sense. I don't need a source from Torah or Gemara to exclude women from saying God's name in the Zimun. Why? Sharei ein mehem das legadel uluromem shemosh al kashbaruch hu kanashim uksiv gadul Hashem iti. Because they, women, do not have the intellectual capacity to exalt and lift up God's holy name like men do. And it's written, gadul Hashem iti, make God great with me. Women don't have the intellectual capacity to do that, says Rabbeinu Manoach. Okay. Before I take questions and comments on this very troubling passage, I want to do two things. I want to first name the problems, both technical and ethical, with each of the arguments here. And I also want to be melamed zuchus. I also want to try to read Rabbeinu Manoach generously so we don't simply dismiss him because he is so offensive, which, again, is true. But I want to take something serious from him nonetheless. So what does he say? He says that women are not a kahal, which he simply asserts, right? Okay, maybe I think women are a kahal. He also says, B'nei Yisrael v'lo b'nos Yisrael. Well, not only, I saw some of your faces when I was reading that, right? Not only is that not the way we normally translate B'nei Yisrael certainly includes my spouse and my daughter, right? But also there are places in the Gemara and for that matter in the Torah where it uses the phrase B'nei Yisrael and explicitly includes women. So you can't tell me that B'nei Yisrael, ipso facto, excludes women. That's a bad argument. Again, the Gemara sometimes makes that argument. It doesn't make it by minyan. But you can't make that argument across the board because there are clearly many places where it simply doesn't hold. Finally, the Meraglim, the spies, I've already dismissed that as, you know, we wouldn't say that you have to be evil people to count the Minyan. So I can't assume that the identity of the spies determines the identity of those in the Minyan. And finally, his last argument that is simply logical, that women lack intellectual capacity to do this. Well, in fact, I know that that's not true. And you know that that's not true. I don't need a source to tell me that women in my world are every bit as capable as men. I'm even saying that in that horrible formulation I just said it in, hurts me to say it, right? It's like, because the assumption that men are the standard is already problematic. So everything about this is problematic from A to Z. And I do want to take seriously for a moment that the Rabbeinu Manoach might not be simply being misogynistic here, but actually reflecting an unfortunate but very real circumstance in the world in which he lived. Namely, if I live in a world in which women are excluded from public gatherings, if I live in a world in which women are excluded from formal education, well, then I'm going to live in a world in which women are not viewed by men or women as being full members of the community. And I'm going to live in a world in which women are at an intellectual disadvantage, right? the smartest woman in medieval France was certainly smarter than the dumbest man in medieval France. But on average, if women were excluded from education, well, then it might actually be the case, unfortunately, terribly, offensively, that what Rena Manoch is saying here is not only misogyny, but it's also the result of misogyny, right? That is to say, it might reflect an experience that he actually saw, but that is not inherently true. It's not about gender. It's about gender in a misogynistic patriarchal world. Okay.
So when you read the Gemara, you're very aware of the cultural milieu out of which it's grown. And I mean, I'm doing Daf Yomi, and I'm so sick of seeing women and slaves on the same page, even minors. But I understand that that was part of the culture. And it sounds like Sefer Manoach is also intensely grounded in the culture of the time. Are we to assume that once we have culture and halacha married to each other, that they never come apart?
Right. Great. So I'll say three things. First of all, next week, God willing, you will see a source that, like you, is totally sick of seeing women and slaves compared, and will offer a way to read those sources such that we no longer do that. So hold on until next week to get some relief from that awful repeated trope that we always see. I will say, the second thing I'll say is not a response to you, but I just want to remind us all that just like the Gemara is a product of its time, and just like Rabbi Manoach is a product of his time, we're also products of our time, right? There are all sorts of things that we just instinctively assume that we don't realize we're assuming because it's the air we breathe, right? It's just, so I don't want to suggest, I don't think you were suggesting this, Rhonda, but I want to make sure that we're all being clear that we're no better than Rabbi Manoach, right? Like we're also totally imbricated in the culture in which we live. In terms of what does that mean in terms of halakhic methodology, there's no right answer. Well, I think there's a right answer. I think what I'm going to tell you is my opinion is the right answer. That's why I believe it. But obviously, I want to be clear. Different teachers would have different takes on what they would say here. What I would say, and this is what I learned from my teacher, Rav Elisha Anshulovich, is that halakha never changes. How halakha manifests changes, right? The values and concerns that lead to a halakhic ruling lead to ruling X in a certain context. But where the context changes, well, now we have to actually change how we understand that. His example of this, one of his favorite examples of this is, if I tell you, you've got to give a child cold chocolate milk on a hot summer day so they don't dehydrate, well, then that doesn't mean if you're in a world where there's no chocolate milk, you just let that kid dehydrate, right? The value, the core concern of that halakha is make sure the kid drinks something that they'll want to drink so that they don't dehydrate. In a world with chocolate milk, that's the thing I give my kid to make sure that they drink enough. Right? But in a world where I have Gatorade, maybe I can give them Gatorade, right? So the halakha hasn't changed, but if the culture changes, how the halakha manifests will change. And that's actually, I mean, since I won't be with you next week, I'll say it my way, right? Tom might say it differently. I'm going to tell you now, I don't think the halakha has changed on gender and minyan. The halakha, I will say now, again, there's a bit of a spoiler, but I have to get it in since I won't be here next week. The halakha has always been fully emancipated members of the community count in a minyan. And for most of Jewish history, unfortunately, that meant men. And in a world where that includes women, The halakha didn't change. The reality changed. So that's my take on that. But again, that's a broader methodological question that other folks would respond to differently. Rabbi Yitan might respond to that differently, even though there are other folks in the world who respond to it even more differently.
Okay, not to fight this, and also like kind of practically, I'm coming from a background where I dive in Egal. But what do you do with the fact that like women are not fully emancipated, right? Like we can kind of pretend that women are not pretend that women are equal, right? But like we can pretend that we live in a world in which women are equal, but practically that's not true. So yep. What do we do with that?
Yeah, that's one of the two arguments that always really challenge. Like there are most of the arguments for non-egalitarian davening don't bother me, don't sway me at all. What Hannah was just raising, that's actually one of the two arguments that I do have some concerns about. But I think fundamentally what we get to is the question of, do you think halakha in general, but also in particular, has to be a leading indicator or a lagging indicator, right? I think it's clear that women are more equal now than they were in Rabbeinu Manoach's time. I think it's clear that for the people in this room, women are equal, right? There's a reason you're here, I assume. I don't know all of you, but I assume that's the case. And I also recognize that women still make, I forget what the number is now, but not a dollar on the dollar for equal work to what men do, right? So on the one hand, we've achieved far greater equality and we want perfect equality, and then we don't really have it. So if someone says to me after learning all these sources, yeah, I need to work hard to get to a world where women are fully equal, and then I can have an egal, I'm going to disagree with them because I'm going to say, I think that's the world we live in enough that to have a non-egalitarian minion actually becomes a mockery of itself. That's my position. But I wouldn't say that person is making a ridiculous argument, right? Like that, if that's the person's argument, I'm sad about it, but I don't think they're fundamentally making a weak argument as opposed to, for example, the spies were men, which I think is a terrible argument. So I hear that, Hannah. I just think that, you know, for me, again, I think Rabbi Tam will probably speak about this next week as well. But for me, when I go to it into a non-egalitarian minion in a modern from community, right? Not a Haredi community, but a modern from community, where in every other aspect of our lives, we're basically equal, right? My spouse and I, we don't assume that one of us has domination over the other. So to have gender separation and gender imbalance in my prayer space tells me that my prayer space doesn't really matter. I don't take it seriously because it's like okay to sort of not be real. So that's where I come down on that. But again, it's a really important question. Okay. So that's related to Manoah. A lot of arguments, all of which can easily be diffused and which we shouldn't dismiss out of hand as being pure misogyny, but actually reflecting a cultural reality. All right. So if we really want to think about minion and gender, what we have to do is think through, well, what does it actually mean to count in a minion, right? Leaving aside gender for the moment, what is it that would cause me to say that person X or person Y does or does not count in a minion? We're going to see two arguments for what it means to count in a minion, two different arguments. The first one is source number 10, Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam says like this, V'ani mosif afilu mutal ba'arisa, I add even a baby in his cradle counts towards the minion. Why? De'achol be'asar ashchin tesharia. On every group of 10, and he doesn't say it, but he means Jews, on every group of 10 Jews, God's presence dwells. De'chi gemire kedusha be'asar mevidi tashti, because when I learned sanctifying God's name with 10 from the verse, I will be sanctified, niktashti, lo shana gedolim, lo shana ketanim. The verse doesn't say, I will be sanctified amidst the adult Jews. It says, I'll be sanctified amidst B'nai Yisrael, irrespective of age. And therefore, Kedusha, holiness, inheres in all Jews. There's a whole other thing to talk about Jews and Gentiles here, but we're not going to do it for the sake of time. And because it's not our topic. Ubilvaji Tesha gedolim. Provided, however, that 9 of the 10 are adults. Now, this is going to be an interesting problem, right? Because if this verse doesn't distinguish between adults and children, well, then why would you limit it to 9 adults and 1 child? Says Rabbeinu Tam, "Detvei mechad lo kinamrinan gabei eved." More than one does not count, as we said in the Talmud about a slave. 9 Jews and 1 slave count, but it never says, and it explicitly says the opposite, 8 Jews and 2 slaves would not be a valid minion. Why not? The leki yakar deshamaya kulehai. Because if you had 2 slaves, or 5, or let's actually, it's easier, I think, to understand with children. 5 children, if I'm a minion of 8 children and 2 adults, that is not so enriching to heaven. It's not yakara deshamaya. Why not? Well, I wouldn't send kids to be my representatives before the government. So I'm certainly not going to send kids to be my representatives before God, right? It's like the adults in the community can't be bothered to go to shul, so we send our kids there. The Eved Nami, I see bichlal v'nikdashti. And a non-Jewish slave also is in the category of I will be sanctified amidst the Jewish people. Why? Because the divine presence dwells on all who are either obligated to commandments, like a non-Jewish slave who's obligated, again, classically, like a woman, in all the non-time-bound commandments, or people who are B'nai Bris, people who are Jews, members of the covenant. So anyone who is either a Jew or obligated mitzvos counts towards a minion. So the minor counts because they're a Jew, even though they're not obligated. A slave counts because they're obligated, even though they're not a Jew. He doesn't talk about a woman, but a woman is both obligated in mitzvos at the same level as a slave. I mean, I think even more, but he thinks at the same level as a slave. And they're a Jew. So certainly, he doesn't say this, but certainly a woman then would count, right? And I'm going to leave out the end of here because I don't think it's actually essential to repeat some things we talked about in previous weeks. And so Rabbeinu Tam's logic would naturally lead to saying that a woman counts towards a minion. Now, it might mean that a woman only counts as one member of the 10. It's just like as a minor and a slave only counts as one member of the 10. First of all, I will tell you, I was just talking to a student of mine today. She was at a Marv minion last night where there were 9 men and she was there. And she was like, guys, count me. I'm the 10th, right? So I don't want to dismiss the importance of even that, right? For her, that was very a hard moment to be in, to not be counted as a 10th. And practically speaking, this could actually be very helpful. But more importantly, we have to ask, well, why is the Eved, why is the slave or the minor limited to one? Because it's not Yakarad Shamaya Kulehai. It's not so enriching of heaven. Are we going to say that the presence of 10 women in a minyan is somehow dishonorable to God, right? You can almost hear the echoes of what we talked about the last couple of weeks of Fodet Tzibur, right? Are we going to say, like, I get why a minyan of 10 5-year-olds is not respectful, but a minyan of 10 women, again, this goes back to both Hannah and Rhonda's questions before, right? In our world, that's no less disrespectful. That is, I hope, and I'm sure I have all sorts of latent misogynies in me, right? But at least at the explicit level, I'm gender blind, right? I don't see any difference between women and men in terms of how much honor we give to God through our presence. So that's Rabbi Thomas' position. He doesn't talk about women, so slaves and minors, but it naturally leads to that position on women. You can see it in source number 11 and 12. We'll just do one of them for the sake of time. This is the Mordechai, a 13th century medieval German author. Gam Rabbeinu Simcha haya osem maaseh v'tzeref isha li'asara lezimun. Right? Rabbeinu Simcha would count a woman or women, in the Hebrew is ambiguous, towards the 10 for Zimun. And in source number 12, he says explicitly, also the 10 for davening, also a minion. And actually, we don't need to do the rest, right? And this is actually clearly based on Rabbeinu Tom's logic. You'll see a source next with Rav Eitan that says that explicitly. That for the Mordechai, Rabbeinu Tom's logic leads explicitly, and for Rabbeinu Simcha, practically, he actually did this. In the medieval period in Germany, he actually counted either a woman or some number of women for dominion, right? This is actually represented as something that Rabbeinu Simcha actually did himself. So if we're in the model of dominion that Rabbeinu Tom offers us, it's about God's presence dwelling on the Jewish people. The Jewish people are defined as people who are either obligated in mitzvos or Jewish by birth, Jewish by identity, that they're B'nai B'ris, they're members of the covenantal community. Well, women are both of those things. They are members of the covenantal community, and they are obligated in mitzvahs. So that's one route that we can see, and you'll see more of it next week. Before we go, though, I want to see one other alternative way of thinking about this. Source number 13, the Levush. The Levush is a very early commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. Shortly after the Shulchan Aruch, Levush comes along and comments, and he says like this. The Eved de'isha ve'katan, a slave, a woman, and a minor, again, that terrible triumvirate, ein mitzdarfin, they don't count towards a minion. Why? She'einam chayvim b'mitzvos, because they are not obligated in the commandments. Now, notice he doesn't say they're not obligated in the mitzvah of prayer, because he knows that they are. He says they're not obligated in mitzvos. Now, we know that women and slaves, even classically, again, that terrible juxtaposition, we know that even classically, they are obligated in mitzvos, right? But they're not obligated to all of them. They're exempt from positive time-bound commandments. And so what he must mean is that they are not maximally obligated. They're not fully obligated. Because there's a large category of exemption for them, they're not fully in. V'yesh matirim b'teishav etzeruv katan. Some allow one minor to count. Why? Kivan sheyachol la'agia l'chol chiyuv mitzvos. Since a minor will come to be obligated to all the mitzvos, a minor male, therefore, a minor could potentially count as one of the 10. This is a totally different framework for what it means to count in a minyan, right? Unlike Rabbeinu Thomas says, it's either obligation in mitzvos, and he clearly means that generally, because a slave is not obligated maximally, or a member of the covenantal community, that's Rabbeinu Tom. For the Levush, to count in a minyan, you have to be maximally and fully obligated in commandments. Women and slaves are not. They are exempt from time-bound commandments. More on that next week. And therefore, they don't count in a minyan. And according to Levush, unless you're willing to make a more radical claim, I won't say more about that yet. You'll see more about this next week with Rav Eitan. Unless you're willing to make a more radical claim, this is going to shut down the conversation, right? Okay, women are not, classically speaking, obligated all the commandments. And therefore, they're not fully member. And therefore, they don't count towards the minyan. I will add that the Levush is important not only technically, but also helps us get at something that I think many people feel instinctively about the exemption of women from time-bound commandments, which is to say, what is Levush saying low-key, sort of in a not explicit way? He's saying, well, you can't count a dominion because you're not a full member of the community if you're not fully obligated, right? Classical Torah Judaism is an obligation-based religion. And if I'm not fully obligated, then I'm not fully a member of the community. And this, as much as it's hard technically, is very helpful, particularly why so many of us are bothered by the exclusion of women from a minion. Because what you're fundamentally saying is, I'm not a member of the community, not me. So a woman is not a member of the community. And that obligation of commandments is actually part and parcel of that. I think that's an important thing to take away from this. Don't give up on Lavush. You will see a source next week that makes Lavush possible, that creates a framework in which Lavush would actually also possibly work for egalitarian davening. But for now, ending here for this week, I will simply say that if we follow the model of Rabbeinu Tam, which is both the earliest and the dominant model in authorities, then it is very straightforward to say, well, then women should count in a minion at least as one, and probably without limit. Certainly for someone like me, who is unwilling to say that it's less honorable to count women in a minion, without limit. If you follow Lavush, things are harder. You'll need to wait for next week for a source that for some of you will be convincing and others may not be, a more sort of bold way to sort of argue for egalitarian minion.
Just some things that are like percolating in my head.
Yeah.
One, like in very traditional communities where men and women are not seated together because of not only because of, you know, not being an egalitarian davening, but because they don't want to see the women, or, you know, whatever the distraction factor or whatever reasons, men and women are not seated together. Often the mechitza completely blocks them. So a lot of things would come out of that. I mean, one is maybe, you know, it doesn't look like a tzibur, it doesn't look like a kahal, because you're not seeing the women, or they're like two separate groups almost. And I don't know if, you know, if that would still be kind of like a factor, and you know, and how you would incorporate, how one would incorporate an egalitarian davening structure while maintaining separate seating, or is that so? It's like so hard to put together.
Yep. Great. So I'll give you a technical response, a substantive response, and a sociological response. The technical response is that, leaving aside places where there's like literally a separate room for women.
But even the same room, right, but like a separation.
But leaving that aside, right? But where there's a mechitza that doesn't go all the way to the top of the wall, which any community that's even in this conversation about egalitarian davening does not have a mechitza like that. You're talking about, you know, because the mechitza goes up 10 tefachim maybe, right? But where there's still visibility, that's not a halakhic obstacle to say you're all part of one room, because there's still a line of sight. And in fact, I've been in minyanim, both in America and in Israel, that are egalitarian in terms of counting in the minyan, but do have separate seating. So it's actually practically done. If you're ever interested in going to such a minyan, I can give you a little list of minyanim like that are separate seating, but egalitarian vis-a-vis counting in the minyan. The substantive response I wanted to offer you is that, you know, we're not talking about that world, but like if you were talking about the Haredi world, where it's not just at davening that they sit separately, but at Shabbos meals, not in the whole Haredi world, but in certain parts of the Hasidic world, where they sit separately for Shabbos meals, at weddings are separate. There's really minimal to zero interaction between women and men. Well, there, I think there actually is a real question, right? They goes back to what, I forget if it was Hannah or Rhonda who raised it, but like they really are living in a world in which the separation between the genders is so real that I'm not sure they should be egalitarian in their
friends. Meshed in the daily life, yeah.
And then I'm forgetting what the third response I was going to offer was.
And if I can ask one other thing, this is different. I mean, I know like, you know, another category, another problematic category, you know, in the Gemara is deaf mute. And, you know, that's been like, nobody would ever now say that a deaf person doesn't have mental capacity, and deaf people are counted in a minion, and deaf people called up to the Torah, and thank God they are. But so how did that change so rapidly, but not for women?
I'm going to leave that to the end.
I know it's a whole different class probably, but.
it is. And my teacher, I don't know how your modern Hebrew is. My teacher actually has an article about exactly that topic. So if you have good modern Hebrew, I can send you that article. Otherwise, we can find time to talk about it. But let's leave it to the end and see if we have time. I want to go to Brandon and then Hannah.
All right. Forgive my contrarian streak. I ask this not because it's an opinion I hold, but because it's one I want to be sure all the bases are
covered. Bob Malahashi, you got another response? Yeah. Yeah, go for it.
So the understanding of this last session and also the conversation around Kvod HaTzibur is that there's a social context that we're living in. There are times, there are norms, there are things that we think and we believe, and that influences what's being said, and both how we understand sort of who we are, what our identity is, what our roles and places are. Do these sources see themselves? Do they have the same kind of self-awareness that you expressed, where you said we are also the product of our times, just as they're the product of the times? Do they see themselves that way? Or do they see themselves as getting at, no, actually there is some essential character difference between men and women?
So I don't think these sources speak in those terms, but I do think we see that in the debate of the Beis Yosef and the Bach that we saw many weeks ago when we were talking about Torah reading, where the Beis Yosef says, a community can just waive its honor, right? What does that mean? What he's really saying is, well, like in a certain cultural circumstance, we're not bothered by that anymore, right? We're not bothered by it enough to not do that thing. And so that's a reflection of that. The Beis Yosef is like, yeah, of course these things change in different cultural circumstances. Even the Bach, who thinks you can't waive that honor, I think is reflecting that, because he's not, I don't think he's saying, this is just an absolute truth that's always true irrespective of the circumstances. But what he's saying is, you got to focus not on what offends you, but what offends God. And that will be determined by cultural circumstances. But the Bach is a little harder. I think, you know, on a literal reading of the Bach, it's easier to say, like, no, he actually is saying it's an absolute truth. That said, the Bach is generally not the position we hold by, right? He loses that to the Beis Yosef. So if you want to play on technical grounds, the Beis Yosef wins, and he's the one who I really think clearly says what you're saying. I think even the Bach is saying what you're saying also. Does that answer your question?
It does.
Awesome. I once a friend of mine asked, does that answer your question? And the person responded, no, and he didn't have anything else to say. So I tried to train myself never to say that, but I slipped.
Yeah. It at least gives me somewhere to go next in my thinking.
Great.